before I continue here with Kruger's account, many of these incidents, and we're not going to go into them here, were related in considerable detail in other Radio Free America shows, notably Radio Free America 19, dealing with the P2 Lodge and its intersection with many of the same elements we've talked about here. Continuing with Kruger's account. Paladin's bankrollers included Skorzeny's weapons empire and Libyan head of state Muammar Gaddafi. The Skorzeny-controlled World Armco, with its main offices in Paris, was registered in the name of Paladin manager von Schubert. Upon the death of Skorzeny in 1975, von Schubert moved to Argentina, but returned 6 months later to reorganize. In the spring of 1976, he raised eyebrows with a want ad in the International Herald Tribune for a pilot, navigator, captain, 3 demolitions experts, 2 camouflage experts, 2 specialists in Vietnamese, and 2 in Chinese. Applicants were directed to a paladin office in Spain. Internacional Fascista was a crucial first step toward fulfilling the dream not only of Skorzeny, but also of his close friend in Madrid exile, José López Rega, Juan Perón's Grey Eminence, and Prince Justo Valerio Borghese, the Italian fascist money man who had been rescued from execution at the hands of the World War II Italian resistance by future CIA counterintelligence whiz James J. Angleton. They and other Nazi and fascist powers throughout Europe and Latin America envisioned a new world order built on a fascist iron circle linking Buenos Aires, Santiago, Lima, La Paz, Brasilia, and Montevideo. In 1973, their goal seemed near. Chile's President Allende had been overthrown. Perón had regained the Argentine presidency after 17 years of exile. Hugo Banzer was still in control in Bolivia, as was Alfredo Stroessner in Paraguay, and other right-wing military regimes ruled Brazil and Uruguay. When he returned to Argentina, Perón brought with him López Rega as an advisor. The latter would wield great influence over both the aging president and his wife Isabel, and import hatchet men from Spain to help the Argentine Anti-Communist Alliance, the AAA, slaughter the Argentine left. In 1976, however, fascist plans suffered a setback. Isabel Perón, who had succeeded her late husband, was ousted from office and López Rega was chased out of Argentina. Argentina's contingent of international terrorists then followed López Rega back to Spain and were joined there by several of their Argentine colleagues, among them Commissioner Morales and Colonel Navarra. Portugal's revolution and the liberation of Mozambique and Angola that followed further complicated the fascist game plan. However, Third World terrorist actions continued. In 1976, a 7-man fascist commando group dispatched from Spain was arrested in Algeria following an act of sabotage. Its leader identified himself as Aurelio Bertin. In truth, he was J. S. Sablonsky, a native Philadelphian also known as J. Salby. Another member of the unit disclosed that he had contacted it in Madrid through one Gilles Maxwell, an American working for a real estate agency run by the former U.S. Air Force Colonel August Woltz, W-O-L-T-Z.
Continuing, Salby was a ringleader of Agenter Press, and later the ELP. Together with Guérin Serac and other Euro-fascists, he had worked for the CIA in Guatemala from 1968 to 71 in the unprecedented terror campaign which followed the August 1968 assassination of U.S. Ambassador Gordon Main. The campaign, allegedly set in motion by Main's successor Nathaniel Davis, was modeled after Vietnam's Phoenix program. It afforded an early glimpse at the teamwork of European fascists with Miami-based CIA-trained Cuban exiles. According to Amnesty International, some 30,000 people were either killed or disappeared in Guatemala in the decade beginning in 1962, the worst of it coming in 1970 to 71. A later released FBI document revealed that Salby and former OAS terrorist Rangier, mentioned at the start of this chapter, had been in Miami in 1969 on leave from participating in mass murder in Guatemala. Correspondence in 1971 from Agenter Press leader Serac to Sablonsky is addressed to J. Salby, Seaboard Holding Corporation, 1451 Northeast Bayshore, Miami. Rangier again shuttled between Miami and Guatemala in late 73. As to Ambassador Davis, he moved on to bigger things in Chile. A terrorist contingent which would train commandos for the Chilean Fascist Party, Patria y Libertad, whose co-leader was reportedly Davis's next-door neighbor, followed soon on his heels from Guatemala. After a coup d'état replaced Salvador Allende with Augusto Pinochet's military junta, some terrorists moved on to Argentina, while others, Salbi among them, rejoined Agenter Press in Portugal. As fascist terror then struck Europe, Davis became the U.S. ambassador in Bern, Switzerland. By coincidence, DINA's chief of foreign operations, Pedro Ewing, set up an office in the same city. The southern European left, most vocally the Italians, then protested repeatedly against the presence of Davis, who was regarded as a coordinator of the terror. Eventually, he was relegated to the happy hunting ground of the Foreign Service, the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. In 1976-77, Internacional Fascista made its presence felt often in Europe. West Germany's fascist and neo-Nazi groups doubled. After Spain and Italy, though, it was in France that the fascists were most industrious, with the old standbys from SAC assuming a new role. When 7,000 SAC agents were fired in 72-73, many joined fascist groups in Spain, Paladin in particular. Paladin's OAS contingent let bygones be bygones.
Continuing. What has made sleuth work difficult is Internacional Fascista's attempts to camouflage itself as an arm of the left. When General Joaquin Centeno Anaya, Bolivia's ambassador to France, was shot down in Paris in May of 1976, a caller to the police claimed that the Che Guevara brigade had murdered him to avenge the 1967 capture of Guevara in Bolivia. An eyewitness, moreover, claimed to have recognized the assailant as the infamous left-wing terrorist Carlos. However, 1 month later, the Nouvel Observateur reported that the assassination had been planned at Madrid's Consulata Hotel by Bolivian intelligence agent Saavedra and three terrorists from the Paladin group. Furthermore, inspection of Centeno Anaya's politics revealed his opposition to Bolivian President Banzer and allegiance to ex-President Torres, whose murder in Argentina followed shortly after Centeno's. Then it was the turn of former Chilean Foreign Minister Orlando Letelier to be murdered by Chilean and Cuban terrorists in Washington, soon after which the establishment U.S. press, citing CIA and FBI sources, pointed the finger at the Chilean left. I would interrupt here that the CIA director at the time was George Bush. In connection with these assassinations, it's appropriate here to quote in its entirety a recent report entitled Latin America, Murder Incorporated, unquote. Again quoting, a still-classified staff report on questionable foreign intelligence operations in the United States, prepared for the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee on International Operations, shed some new light on cooperation and security matters between Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, Chile, Paraguay, and Uruguay. According to the Senate report, which has been leaked to the press in the United States, the joint operation is known as Condor. The Senate report mentioned a Phase 3 of Operation Condor, which involved the formation of special teams to carry out sanctions, unquote, including the assassination of the enemies of its constituent governments. The best-known killing of this type was the bomb attack on Orlando Letelier in September of 1976 in Washington. Condor's role in this emerged during the testimony of the FBI agent Bob Shearer, who investigated the case and gave evidence at the trial of Michael Townley. He testified to the use of Condor as the channel by which the Chilean DINA chief, General Manuel Contreras, tried to get U.S. visas for two of the agents involved. An impressive list of murders may now be laid at the door of Operation Condor. These include the killings of General Carlos Prats of Chile and Juan José Torres of Bolivia in Argentina, the Uruguayan politicians Hector Guitares Ruiz and Zelmar Michelini, also in Argentina, Bolivia's General Joaquin Centeno Anaya and Uruguay's Colonel Ramon Trabal in Paris, and the attempted assassination of the Chilean Senator Bernardo Leighton. The Senate report disclosed that Condor had considered establishing its own operational base in Miami in 1974, but that this was headed off by a CIA protest, quote, through regular intelligence channels, unquote. In this case, the CIA informed the Chilean DINA of United States displeasure, and no Miami station was opened. According to the Senate report, the FBI concluded early in its investigation of the Letelier assassination that the murder might have been carried out as a third phase of Operation Condor. Presumably, third phase will now go into the lexicon of euphemisms alongside the CIA's to terminate with extreme prejudice. The fact that the operation was well known to the United States at least 5 years ago makes nonsense of its shocked surprise at the time of Orlando Letelier's death, end quote. That was all a direct quote of the report.
Continuing. The advent of democracy in Spain was fought bitterly by Internacional Fascista. At least 70 lives fell victim to the struggle within the first half of 1977. On January 24th, fascists armed with machine pistols stormed a Midtown Madrid attorney's office and opened fire on 12 lawyers who had defended leftists. Six of the lawyers were killed, the rest were seriously wounded. Over the next 3 days, right-wing terrorists murdered four others, two of them students, which led to the arrest of Carlos Perez, the Cuban exile associated with the Argentine AAA. On February 22, 1977, Madrid police discovered a factory where Italian Ordine Nuovo fascists had manufactured handguns. The building had been rented from an order of nuns by Otto Scorzani's friend Mariano Sanchez Covisa. Following up their discovery, the police investigated a bank box in the name of Italian fascist kingpin Elio Massagrandi. In it, they found a small fortune and three gold bars traceable to the $10 million bank robbery masterminded by OAS alumnus Albert Spaggiari. This led to the roundup of most of Spain's Italian fascist elite: Stefano Della Chiai, Marco Pozan, Elidore Pomar, Clemente Graziani, Salvatore Francia, Flavio Camp, Mario Rosa, Enzo Salzioli, plus Massagrandi and his wife Sandra Cricci. Spanish authorities, however, were pressured by the Italians' local protectors, and the terrorists were soon released. Many of them headed to Argentina and eventually returned to Europe. Massagrandi and one Gaetano Orlando went to Paraguay, where they were arrested in December 1977 and released within days on orders from dictator Stroessner. There they remained. In August 1977, the Spanish AAA stole jewels worth $20 million from the cathedral at Oviedo. The police recovered most of the jewels when several terrorists were stopped at the Portuguese border. That same month, Internacional Fascista's Italian, Spanish, Argentine, and Cuban exile terrorist contingents were represented at a Taiwan assembly of the World Anti-Communist League.
Continuing. In April of 1978, the parties behind Internacional Fascista formed an umbrella organization, Eurodroit, or Euro-Right, as a response to Euro-Communism. Charter members included Giorgio Almirante's Italian Fascist Party, MSI, Spain's Fuerza Nueva, led by Blas Pinar, France's Force Nouvelle, PFN, led by Jean-Louis Tixier-Vigancourt, Belgium's Front National, and Greece's Rassemblement Général. In May, Almirante and others represented Eurodroit at the Wacol Assembly in Washington. On June 27, 1978, Eurodroit met in Paris, and on July 18, its leaders met in Madrid with Latin American observers including Ricardo Curuche of Argentina. Its representative at the April 1979 Wacol Assembly in Paraguay was Fuerza Nueva's Pinar. Finally, in 1979, several Eurodroit members were elected to the first European Parliament. The springboard of this chapter was what I deem the Miami Conspiracy. Inevitably, I am drawn to suspect that international fascist operations are, to some degree, directed from Miami. World Service, the cover organization Patrice Charoff told me was based in Miami, was of the same ilk as Agenter Press, whose agents Rangiar and Salbi were in and out of Miami. Miami Cubans joined Agenter Press terrorists in Guatemala. The Nice bank robber Albert Spaggiari was allegedly in Miami before his heist and was definitely in touch with the CIA and the U.S. after it. 10 months later, money and gold stolen from the bank were in the safe deposit box of an Italian terrorist leader in Spain. Mirage director Duvater and Paladin agent K flew to Miami before their theft of Mirage millions and met there with Cuban exiles. 100 Florida-based Cubans joined the Agenter Press ELP army in Spain, where they became involved in acts of terrorism. Michael Townley and other DINA agents were in Miami to plan the murder of Orlando Letelier, and Townley also engineered an attempt on Bernardo Leighton's life in Rome. The old JM Wave operation is born again, only it is no longer confined to Cuba and the Third World, but now encompasses a bitter struggle against a new enemy, Euro-Communism. The hometown of CIA fronts like the Sea Supply Corporation, Double Check Corporation, Zenith Technical Enterprises, Gibraltar Steamship Corporation, and Vanguard Service Corporation, and the site of ominous Fontainebleau Hotel meetings between Santo Trafficante, Sam Giancana, John Roselli, Robert Mayhew, William Harvey, and Meyer Lansky, remains the birthplace of conspiracy. And to close the circle, let us not forget that gangsters and former espionage agents among Internacional Fascista and Carew's minions were knee-deep in the heroin trade, that still floating in the quagmire are extraordinary international agents E. Howard Hunt and Fernand Le Gros, and that several Spaggiari gang bank robbers had been the close associates of both François Chappé and Christian Beausers David, whom this book was at one time to have been all about. We're going to take a break here, and then we're going to come back. We're going to discuss a little bit about the very dense and important chapter we've just been through, and we're going to pick up then, following that discussion, with a discussion of Christian Beausers David, and we're going to talk about some of the August Ricord mob and an extension of the Ricord mob's associated. Well, the Ricord mob was associated with Klaus Barbie, and we're going to talk about an apparent extension of that. And we're going to talk about Klaus Barbie, the cocaine coup in Bolivia of 1980, and another a lot of other equally charming events.
Indeed. So don't go away. We're going to take a break and play some music, give you a chance to wiggle your toes and kick your feet a little bit, and then we're going to be back for more. And as Dave said, we've got another 2 hours of information, all kinds of stuff. So Dave Emery and myself, Nip Tuck, will return in just a few minutes with more of One Step Beyond, right here, One Step Beyond, with more of Radio Free America, excuse me, right here on KFJC. Turn with more of Radio Free America. This is Nip Tuck with Dave Emery in the studios at KFJC. We're going to be here until approximately 11 o'clock tonight, give or take a few minutes one way or the other, because as Dave so aptly put it, we never quite know how these things are going to come off, but time-wise anyway. So, however, we spent a long session. Actually, we should probably review some of that last chapter, because that's a lot of exceedingly complicated stuff having to do with the International Fascista and a veritable crossword puzzle of interlocking acronyms there. The SAC, the OAS, CARU, DINA, ELP, the whole bunch of them. But essentially, the strongest connection that needs to be made tonight, one is not expected to know whether when one says AAA, one is talking about the Spanish AAA or the Argentine AAA. But the point is the very strong connection made early on between the, quote, legitimate intelligence services, organized crime, the drug traffic, and right-wing paramilitary, well, fascist politics and fascist terrorist action. And that's, in fact, as Dave mentioned, drugs, intelligence, and international fascism is, in fact, the title and the category of tonight's broadcast.
Perhaps the most significant aspect of that particular chapter was, well, obviously the information is highly significant, but in his conclusion to that chapter, Henrik Kruger stated that the old JM Wave station is born again. That, with perhaps a very unintentional, though, in the year 1987, the book was written in 1980, an excellent pun on the ultra-right-wing evangelical movement which is going around, that the old JM Wave station, headed by Theodore Shackley, is indeed born again. Something to contemplate here in calendar year 1987 is the extent to which the Contra Supply operation is not only very similar to station JM Wave, in which was basically a CIA covert operation run from the United States with, again, the same sort of coalescing of ultra-right-wing elements, various Nazi and Klan groups, civilian material assistance, and others being basically being taken under the umbrella of the U.S. National Security Establishment. But the incorporation of the nexus of mafiosi, of organized crime, various intelligence agencies around the world, primarily the U.S. intelligence agencies, and specific fascist elements combining to place the operations for right-wing terror around the world, Latin America in particular, under the DEA, for the CIA infiltrated DEA. The interrelationship here between the narcotics traffic and the terrorist elements cited in that chapter is the key thing we're focusing on here. We're going to be coming back to that same nexus in our three-part series, which we have scheduled for May, and we'll be giving you the dates later, which is going to deal with the Iran-Contra scandal, involving many of the same elements and the same people we looked at here. The Internacional Fascista, and specifically that passage we've read in a number of other Radio Free America broadcasts, the intersection, for example, of Muammar Gaddafi with the Paladin Group, the right-wing Italian elements, well, right-wing, that's a euphemism, the fascist Italian elements such as Stefano Della Chiai, Prince Justo Valerio Borghese, and some of the others we looked at, José López Rega of the Argentinian P2. We looked at them in great detail in our series about the Pope shooting, Radio Free America's 17 through 21. Theodore Shackley, a key player in that situation, is also obviously one of the individuals who looms large in this whole complex. The book that we're reading from, The Great Heroin Coup, again, it was copyrighted in 1980, came out right at the end of that year. Obviously, I think in calendar year 1987, has turned out to be rather unnervingly prophetic. The very same Miami conspiracy that we're looking at, basically Kruger postulates that Miami is the nerve center of international fascism, closely allied with the U.S. national security establishment, looms even larger in the wake of the revelations of the Iran-Contra scandal, and we're going to be looking at those, as I said, in great detail in May in another series. Now, one of the elements in Harold Kruger's analysis here that we're going to be looking at concerns Chrétien Beausserge David. He was a Corsican gangster employed first by the SAC, the anti-OAS group of Corsican gangsters employed by the French government to resist the attempted fascist coup in France. Later, as Kruger has indicated, particularly after the 1968 riots and street demonstrations in Paris, the SAC was welcomed back by the ultra-right-wing elements in Paris, and in France, I should say, and the SAC became part of the Internationale Fascista. We're going to go back to the Great Heroin Coup now, and we're going to take a look at the functioning of Chrétien Beausserge David. His nickname was Beausserge. We're going to look at his role not only working with the Ricord mob. Auguste Ricord was a Corsican gangster, a Nazi collaborator who fled to Latin America to avoid prosecution by the French authorities after the war. He then teamed up with, among others, Klaus Barbie, the SS and Gestapo chief of Lyon. Klaus Barbie, of course, as we've looked at in the past and has been widely, widely documented in the popular press, as well as any number of books, Klaus Barbie worked as an agent of the Galen Organization. And we're going to be taking a look at the collaboration of Klaus Barbie, Auguste Ricord, and Chrétien David, not only in the heroin trade, but also in operating hand in glove with right-wing death squads in particularly Uruguay and Brazil. And in particular, we're going to take a look at the looming in the background of that is, of course, the CIA and the other U.S. intelligence services. Following our analysis of Henrik Kruger's, our expose, I should say, our reading of Henrik Kruger's analysis of the Auguste Ricord, Barbie, Chrétien David collaboration and their role with death squads, we're going to move on to an analysis of Klaus Barbie, his cocaine operation in Bolivia, and the so-called cocaine coup of 1980 involving the fiancés of death that we looked at in Radio Free America number 19, the group of cocaine mercenaries, basically, who operated hand in glove not only with the Bolivian National Security Establishment, but with elements of our own. And the cocaine trade is going to loom large in the final couple of hours of our broadcast this evening. Obviously, we will be looking at cocaine smuggling and its intersection with the U.S. National Security Establishment in our analysis of the Iran-Contra scandal.
Okay, reading from The Great Heroin Coup. Auguste Ricord and his gang of heroin merchants were riding high when they were joined by Chrétien David in the latter half of the 60s. Each year, they transported hundreds of kilos to the huge U.S. market, and without the noticeable losses that narcotics traffickers must normally contend with. Its street value, depending on competition, lay somewhere between $1 and $2 billion annually. At the end of World War II, Ricord fled from France in a death sentence for collaboration with the Gestapo. He wandered for several years in search of an underworld niche. By the end of the second year, three of his companions in exile had been murdered. In 1947, Ricord arrived in Buenos Aires with the name Lucien Dargel. Some say he had with him the millions he'd pocketed during the war. Others say he had to start all over. What's certain is that he opened an exclusive restaurant in Argentina at the close of the 50s and soon had a chain of restaurants and motels throughout Argentina, Paraguay, and Bolivia, each with the name Paris-Nice and an Eiffel Tower prominently out front. The motels evolved into a high-class brothel chain, and Ricord quietly began trafficking in narcotics. At the start of the 60s, Ricord moved his headquarters from Buenos Aires to Asunción, Paraguay. There he could feel at home among the old Nazi luminaries who had found safe haven under President Alfredo Stroessner. Ricord also regained contact with an old acquaintance then residing in neighboring Bolivia, former Gestapo chief Klaus Barbie, the killer or butcher of Lyon. Ricord had much in common with Barbie, alias Klaus Altman, inasmuch as the former had assisted the Gestapo at torture and the rounding up of French Jews. Since the disclosure of Barbie's whereabouts, French and German authorities alike have vainly sought his extradition for the murder of hundreds. In 1966, old man Ricord enlarged his already immense narcotics network upon discovering how easily he could smuggle heroin into the U.S. via Latin America. For some reason, the U.S. Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, the BNDD, largely overlooked the danger from the South until the 70s. It eventually grew wiser, estimating that 50-60% of the Marseille-produced heroin on the U.S. market entered via Latin America, which generally meant by way of Ricord and Company. The old man surrounded himself with hardcore thugs. By 1970, the mob's leaders were Ricord, sentenced to death in absentia for treason, torture, and murder; Lucien Sarti, wanted for the murder of a Belgian policeman; Christian David, sentenced to death in absentia; André Condamine, wanted for the murder of a policeman; Jean Lunardi, wanted for murder; François Chiappe, wanted for two murders; and a French gangster and former SAC agent, Michel Nicoli. They also had a network of henchmen encompassing nearly every metropolis in Latin America. The money poured in, some of it to be reinvested in restaurants and nightclubs in Buenos Aires, Sao Paulo, and Caracas. But Ricord lost his grip on the reins. Before long, David Condamine and Sarti took over, reducing the old man to a figurehead who drank foaming Münchnerbrau with Die Alte Kameraden in one of Asunción's many German bars.
Continuing. Marseille heroin was transported to Paraguay from embarkation points in Barcelona, Lisbon, and Brussels. In charge of transportation were Condamine as well as Chiappe, who often traveled between his Buenos Aires base and Barcelona, where his suppliers were the Orsini brothers of the Corsican Mafia. The heroin was transported by air and by sea. Part of it went via Brazil, then either overland to Paraguay or directly to the USA. Some of it sailed up the Paraná River to Asunción. The greater part of the heroin sent north arrived aboard small planes known as Mau Maus, which generally refueled in Panama before flying on to either Florida or Mexico. There they were unloaded and shipment was continued overland. Paraguay had long been one of the great smuggling centers of the world. With 200 private landing strips scattered among the haciendas, it was impossible to monitor the enormous number of private flights. And no one seriously bothered to try, since numerous government officials pocketed shares of the take. According to Jack Anderson, Ricord's accomplices included some of Paraguay's highest-ranking officers, Pastor Coronel, the intelligence chief, General Andres Rodriguez, leader of an elite 3,000-man force especially trained by the Americans, and General Vicente Quiñones, the Air Force chief of staff, who was responsible for Asunción Airport and other landing fields. Soldiers from an elite corps, according to Anderson, were stationed to guard the contraband stores for Ricord and other big-time smugglers. Worse still, in the wake of Anderson's sensational revelations came rumors that Paraguayan Air Force officers had even flown Ricord's heroin to the United States in military aircraft. Unlike Ricord, David didn't simply rake in the money. He thrived on danger. According to U.S. narcs, in at least three instances, Beausergé himself transported large quantities of heroin into the United States using the pseudonym Jean-Pierre, by which he was known exclusively among friends in the Ricord mob. David also maintained the organization's good relations with police and spooks in Latin America. He took on assignments for Argentina's terrorist organization, the Argentine Anti-Communist Alliance, or AAA, and probably did the same for Brazil's notorious death squad. Grupo Francais, as Ricord's network was known in Latin America, had found a prize in Chrétien David because of his connections to SAC and French intelligence. Through him, there grew new branches in the narcotics network, including one centered about the Félix Lesca gang and the Lyon SAC chief Jean Auger, and another about Joe Attia's gang, SAC leader Ange-Simon Pierre, and the Swiss banker André Hirsch.
Okay, moving back a little bit to study a little bit more about Beausergue himself. The murder of Police Lieutenant Galibert caused a major sensation in France. Despite what seemed to be an all-out manhunt, the wily Chrétien David, aided by friends, eluded Galibert's colleagues in the anti-gangster squad. In the fetish club of Neuville-sur-Rhin, outside Lyon, Beausergue bided his time. A big-time bordello and a haunt of the Guarini clan, the club was a frequent rendezvous of David's friends in SAC. Reportedly, Meme Guarini at first favored delivering his body to the police, but powerful forces must have intervened as mafia bosses were persuaded to help Beausergue flee from France. One day, in March 1966, a car picked him up at the fetish club and drove him to a Guarini outpost on the outskirts of Marseille. Skipping down. His reputation having preceded him in Latin America, David was welcomed into the Ricord organization with open arms and soon moved into its highest ranks. Also part of Beausergue's reception committee were agents of the SDECE and SAC. His arrival coincided with a powerful French diplomatic offensive in Latin America. With the U.S. wading into a quagmire and into China, and otherwise preoccupied with the Soviet Union, de Gaulle, and more so Jacques Foccart, sought to entrench themselves as deeply in Latin America as they had in Africa. De Gaulle planned to come on like the Great White Father, the Third World's only friend, but Foccart, F-O-C-C-A-R-T, felt that wouldn't suffice. He moved several of his most trusted men from Africa to Latin America. Between 1965 and 1968, for example, we find the notorious Colonel Roger Barbero as France's ambassador to Uruguay, and Dominique Ponchardier its man in Bolivia. If anyone stands for cloaks and daggers, it's these two, whose names turn up in a string of France's most sensitive espionage scandals. Foccart's men moved where they saw the greatest openings, supporting right-wing forces in a region already in the grip of military dictatorship. Barbero and Ponchardier offered to help these regimes break the back of left-wing insurgency. For that, they needed men without scruples, men like Chrétien David. On arrival in Argentina, David met François Chiappe, wanted in France for a pair of murders. Chiappe, also known as Big Lips, had worked for the Guarini mob and was on excellent terms with politicians and right-wing militants in Argentina. He was also a top member of the Ricord organization. The Ricord network was divided into four teams that operated independently out of separate headquarters. Ricord himself ran the main team from Asunción, Paraguay, and oversaw the entire operation. Chiappe and Michel Nicoli led another team, Dominique Orsini and Luis Bonsignor a third, and André Condamine and Lucien Sarti a fourth. Other important names in the organization were Claude-André Pasteur, Didier Baron, and Michel Bouboule-Saint. And I'm not going to bother to spell all the French names because we're not even going to go over many of these too many times. It was murder incorporated in French. Nearly all had been sentenced to death in France.
Continuing. Baroni, besides belonging to the Félix Lesca gang, had teamed up on art swindles with the aforementioned CIA agent Fernand Le Gros and with Legros' forger, Emile d'Ory. Pastu was similarly interesting. In December of 1968, Enrico Pasilli, a weapon-smuggling friend of Chrétien David's, was murdered in Rome. Almost simultaneously, Thierry de Bonnay, another close associate of Legros', died in a mysterious auto accident. Italian police suspected Pastu in both killings, which were committed while he was on a trip back to Europe. The Ricord network operated freely south of the border because its members helped repressive regimes fight the left and smuggle arms, sometimes combining the two profitably. While he was helping intelligence groups infiltrate guerrilla movements, Chrétien David found new customers for his weapons. The major arms deals, though, were with fascist militant groups in Argentina and Chile. Through connections, Schiap secured David an Argentine passport in the name of Carlos Eduardo Devreux Bergeret. Beausers then went on secret missions for French intelligence. His first assignment to infiltrate Douglas Bravo's Venezuelan urban revolutionaries led nowhere. In early 1967, Bravo was expelled from the Venezuelan Communist Party and police smashed his organization. Once relocated in the hills, Bravo was wary of spies. Following the false start in Venezuela, Beausers flew to Mexico and met with two African agents. They handed him a contract to eliminate African politicians. It's not clear whom he was to murder and whether or not he succeeded, but he was in Africa several months, and murder was a task he rarely muddled. Upon returning to Latin America, he joined Reclor in Asunción before planting himself in Argentina. In late 1967, David, alias Eduardo Devreux Bergeret, managed to infiltrate the Fuerzas Argentinas de Liberación, the FAL, one of the most active guerrilla groups in stormy Argentina from 1967 to 71. Among other actions, it kidnapped Auguste Ricord's close friend and Paraguay's consul in Argentina, Valdemar Sanchez.
Relying on his experience with the instruments of death, David soon became the FAL's arms instructor and ingratiated himself with its members. In the end, he made off with its files and a cash box containing $250,000. While fleeing, he allegedly slew an FAL leader and a lookout. He headed with his prize to Central America. Eventually, the SDECE made a deal for the papers with the Argentine government, which led to the arrest of several guerrillas and the death by torture of one. Soon thereafter, David went to Uruguay, where the French ambassador was Roger Barbero, the same Barbero who 4 years later would be associated with the French Connection heroin affair that also involved Beausers. In May 1968, Barbero and Dominique Ponchardier were unexpectedly rushed home to Paris to help quell French student unrest, forcing Focart to put his plans for Latin America on hold. After 1968, Beausers was more or less a freelance agent. While remaining in close touch with the Focart network, he also took on assignments for security police and political death squads in Argentina, Uruguay, and Brazil, and thereby inevitably for the CIA. In Montevideo, he reconnected with his mistress Teresa, who just happened to be a member of the Tupamaros. Through her, Beausers infiltrated Latin America's best-organized band of guerrillas. Uruguay's president, Pacheco Areco, had already begun a determined struggle against the revolutionaries. Assisting his police and armed forces was a squad of CIA agents expert at torture and anti-guerrilla warfare. Two of these agents, Dan A. Mitrione, M-I-T-R-I-O-N-E, and Claude L. Fry, spelled like it sounds, were captured by the revolutionaries. Mitrione was given the death penalty by a people's court, while Fry suffered a heart attack and was released. Beausers appears at first glance to have done more for President Areco than the entire conventional CIA team, but on this job he probably collaborated with U.S. intelligence. Also assisting him was Jacques Focart's full-time man in Uruguay in Roger Barbero's absence, Jean-Baptiste Listroni, who became David's go-between with the Uruguayan government. David must have been quite an actor, since he even fooled the legendary Tupamaros leader, Raúl Sendic. After robbing a bank, the guerrillas handed Beausers $400,000 for the purchase of weapons. He then flew off, as if to complete the deal, to Focart's personal fiefdom and beehive of the weapons trade, the African nation of Gabon. While he was away, however, the guerrillas somehow learned not of his escapades in Argentina, but of his role in the Ben Barca affair. They decided to set a trap for him, but once back in Uruguay, Beausers smelled trouble and rushed to the security police, who soon arrested 150 guerrillas and the strongest blow they'd dealt the revolutionaries. It was a handsome feather in the cap of President Pacheco Areco. For his troubles, David was reportedly given $200,000 in addition to the $400,000 of which he had relieved the partisans, plus an Uruguayan diplomatic passport in the name of Edouard Davrieux. The passport made David the heir apparent of Auguste Ricord. With it, he traveled freely to the U.S. and Europe, controlling and expanding the international narcotics network. There's also a somewhat unbelievable story about David's departure from Uruguay. In the transit hall of Montevideo Airport, a stewardess reportedly brought him a package. Suspecting a bomb, Beauserge had the stewardess open it herself. She screamed when she did. Inside was the head of Teresa, a goodbye gift from the Tupamaros.
Now, the point to make here, of course, is that, as we look at the conclusion of this book, the strong intersection between fascist politics and the narcotics traffic, and in turn, David's work with the U.S. intelligence apparatus in Uruguay, is worth noting here. Now, what we're going to begin looking at next, and we're going to take a look at a section from Parapolitics issue number 6, put out by Jonathan Marshall, we'll get to that in a second, is what appears to have been, at least to a certain extent, an extension of the Ricor mob taken over by Chrétien David. And remember now that Ricor worked closely with Klaus Barbie, only this time the main product that they're moving is cocaine and not heroin. And we're going to take a very close look at the so-called cocaine coup in Brazil in 1980 in just a second. Now again, bear in mind that Chrétien David, a French gangster who at one time, and apparently for quite a while, worked in an official capacity for the French government, worked hand in glove with various reactionary regimes in Latin America, and also apparently with the U.S. intelligence apparatus.